That's roughly the plan of action. Okay. I hope I stick with that. So I'm, I will, yeah. So on Wednesday, I'm going to move to precincts, and religiosity. Yeah. And then I want on Thursday to, at some stage anyway, do something about, it's essentially about where church and politics overlap, but it's going to begin with Jesus and politics and move on like that. And then on Friday, I'll be coming back to an overall picture if I can work out all this. Let me try and complete what I've been at this morning now. I'm suggesting that what we know as a diocese comes to shape itself in the period after 350, that it involves the evangelizing of the villages, a change in the sacrament of orders whereby there is a new interdependence between presbyter and bishop, and most significantly, what I'm now trying to get at, an enrichment of the pastoral vision of the church, whereby it thinks of itself not simply as a congregation of believers in a place, but as a sacrament of salvation in a place, operating not only for the baptized, but also in subtle and not easily described ways for others in the local place. And that actually is where the popular religiosity question comes up in an acute way. Once you stop operating with a congregational model, you're going to come up against popular religiosity in a much more developed way than it happened before. Yeah. A very good question indeed. The era of persecution basically the first two centuries are the era of most vigorous persecution. So by the time of the fourth century, the church is becoming a very revered institution, especially in cities. Romans really didn't rate villages at all. And bishops, who are the ministers in the local cities, are called pater pauperum, the father of the poor in the cities. And they became places that were known as charitable institutions in the cities. And it's then, I suppose, that the confidence develops to evangelize the villages and the kind of developments that occur afterwards. So that's roughly it. Of course, you still get persecutions at the beginning of the fourth century, but they're not very severe. So roughly that would be the time scale. Okay, let me go back to the kind of pastoral vision that I'm trying to say happened at this time and some of its implications. I was suggesting at the end of the last period that there's a change from congregational model to parochial model. And I now want to spell out a little bit what I mean by those. At the end of the fourth century, the church changed its basic working unit from a congregational model to a parochial model. Congregational model was a tightly defined group of believers. The task of the bishop essentially was to sustain the faith of the believers. And the work of evangelization was a work of crossing the boundary in a very clear way from being an unbeliever to being a believer. A parochial model, on the other hand, has the view of the believers here in radiate the presence of grace in the local place and its local story. And the boundaries become less clear. And That development is one that I think is an enrichment of the pastoral vision of the church. So I'm just spelling things out a little bit more clearly now. The congregational model, which is the model of the very early church. And the very early church has quite little to do with popular religiosity, for instance. You actually can see some of it. But popular religiosity begins to be a big theme once you move into a parochial model, because the people in this area have their own expression of prayer and their own expression of religion. They have their holy wells and they have their pilgrimages and various other things like that, and they become part of the material within which the church is radiating grace, and control becomes much more difficult in this kind of context. So the congregational model is about creating identifiable groups of believers and sustaining them. The task and the boundaries are clear. As I say, the Baptist Church to this day operates with a congregational model. The parochial model has less clear boundaries. And it's part of my argument that it could not function without the diocesan diversification of ministry between presbyter and bishop, an interdependence between them. Otherwise, the church up the mountain would very quickly begin to go bananas. It needs a koinonia of a different kind. Because it has got two choices up the mountain, where the Celts live, where my people live. Either it can be consumed by their culture and their forms of religiosity and lose the leaven of the gospel, or it can back off from their culture and their story and create a congregation which is not in a living movement with the story of the local place and the local culture. So that's why the diocesan structure is a pastoral vision and a work of some genius, which can't be easily gainsaid, as I said, in the history of the church. So the parochial diocesan model functions as a congregation for an identifiable membership, but it also functions in a less explicit way for a wide range of people in this place. That's what I was trying to illustrate in what I was saying at the very end in the last time there. If you try to knock down a church in a local area where it's been for a long time, you will find that it's not just the congregation that will have something to say about it, and it's not just the heritage people. It's a lot of people on the fringes of the reality of church suddenly begin to feel, hey, this is our church, even though they're not actually very active participants at all. And constantly you find people from that group who are not actively church-going requesting some form of ministry from church in many different ways, sometimes only along the line of conversation, sometimes along the line of a request for baptism, sometimes along the line of someone to listen to their particular oppression that might be going on. I was taking the example of homosexuality. Does actually look to the church, even though the people concerned might not be church going at all. That's just one example of it. In varied circumstances, it's enabled to minister to a wide range of people, a vehicle through which people can handle hopes and fears arising from troubled areas of human experience. Let me try and put another concrete example into that. Every human community has somehow to try and hold together in the midst of incredible tensions. Thinking back on my own hometown, it's a town with a large agricultural industry in it. Now, any industry has got two opposed interests. Has the opposed interests of the workers and of the shareholders. Now, people in business might say they're not opposed, but three quarters of the time they're opposed. How is that town going to survive without tearing itself apart? How the hope of remaining somehow as a community is a tremendous burden on human beings, not to descend into conflict. And it's that kind of ministering to a human story which is wider than the congregation that is part of the vision of the diocesan structure as it developed here. So there may be a mediation from church to industrial dispute, just to take a concrete example, which actually has nothing to do with church as such, but which has a lot to do with the revelation of grace in this local area. And that's the kind of pastoral vision that develops there. So now, for instance, you begin to see this local church here now, in this parochial diocesan model, let me go back again, that won't work unless there is a new interdependence between the priest in this town and the larger area of the kind that a diocesan presbyterium is. Without that link, the priest in this isolated town is likely to be consumed by the culture of the town and no longer able to be some kind of evangelizing presence to it. But at this time, A, you begin to get a much closer engagement of popular religiosity, and B, the prayers in the liturgy begin to include the themes of the local culture in a much wider way. So in the liturgy now, as we have it shaped, half the time we're not praying for Catholics at all. We're praying for all those who have died in your friendship. They don't have to be Catholics. You're praying for peace in wherever. You're not praying for the needs of the congregation. You're praying for the needs of this group of human people, and then widening out from that to the needs of other groups of human people. The human kind on its way to salvation is the focus of your attention at the liturgy itself. Humankind on its way to salvation, not the human baptized in isolation from humankind. And that's the kind of vision. And therefore, if there begins to be something like education, what does this town need, this poor town? It needs education. Now, are we going to have education for Catholics? Yes, we are. But are we going to draw the boundary and say, if it's not Catholics, you're going to get those kinds of problems coming up acutely. In England, in the last about 3 years, there's been some very, very strong controversies about certain famous Catholic schools which now have a minority of Catholics in them. And there's one famous school run by Oratorians in Birmingham. And some of the Oratorians wanted to close the school on the grounds that it was no longer serving a Catholic community. Not on the grounds of finance, notice now. Finance is a different kettle of fish. This was a school which had good financing, independent financing, and it had a very strong reputation. Many people joined, but the Oratorians went into a phase of thinking, some Oratorians went into a phase of thinking, Catholics serve Catholics. And the outcry against this was very illustrative of what I'm trying to say. Now, many other people say, Catholics serve all the human beings in this area, and it's important that there be a Catholic community in the education in this area, even though it's not all Catholics who are benefiting from it. Now, that's the kind of vision that developed in the developments that I'm working through and is very largely associated with the structure that we call the diocesan structure. It could not work without it. And that's what I think we are in, I wouldn't say in danger of losing, but must be careful not to retrench from. When you have a situation, as we now have, where there are less people coming to church and less priests, you're inclined to say, simplify the operation and serve only those coming to church. Fine, but that's to lose, in my view at least, one of the developments in pastoral vision, which is one of the great enrichments providentially of the Catholic Church. That's to make a move in the direction of the more Protestant churches. And therefore, if we have got a problem nowadays, retrenchment to that sort of more narrow vision is not the solution to it. The solution to it must come from elsewhere, and I think myself it must come from new forms of interdependence in ministry. This whole thing developed because the single bishop moved from being a single figure to being someone who was in interdependence with the presbyterium. And it was a major shift of function and didn't arise without a lot of controversy. It's something similar like that that I think we need to think about. This is the last point I want to make about what I'm called the diocesan parochial vision. Very important point. This task of ministering to a wide range of people is in the mind. I can't tell you how to do it. I can sort of educate you into it and show you people who do it, but it's creative is what I'm saying. It's creative. You don't know what problem is going to come up tomorrow, what person is going to approach you, which will cause you to interpret that vision in a way that is quite unique. Again, to go back on the example of someone approaching for baptism, it's really a lot depends on how you handle that locally. If you say the boundaries are clear, then she, a woman, likely enough, is going to be talking to a lot of other women locally. And they're saying the boundaries are very clear here and there's out and in. And if you're saying there's out and in, to my mind, you're too quickly retreating from being the presence of the revelation of grace here to being a congregation of identifiable believers. Now, I'm not saying that the solution is simply to baptize, but I'm saying the solution is to listen and see how there can be a ministry to someone who is on the margins of church without being in church. And that's a really, really big task and difficult to do. So this task is largely in the mind, and the priest in the parochial community is a key figure in interpreting boundaries that shift as the local story unfolds. That's, to my mind, the most creative part of the ministry of priests locally. You've got to be able to shift as the local story unfolds. Vatican II is where I'm going to turn to briefly now. Vatican II made strenuous efforts to recover this vision. And basically, the concept that it used was the concept of local church. It wanted to say that the church, the whole church, exists locally. And as part of its recovery of a theology of local church was a recovery of its theology of the link between presbyter and bishop. And that's what I'm going to briefly turn to now. Okay. This is one of the key statements of Vatican II on what the church is. In these communities, it says, although they may often be small and poor up the mountain, the villages up the mountain, not in the cities, or existing in the diaspora, Christ is present, and the one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church prays here. That's actually the vision of the diocese. The one holy Catholic Church prays here in this small, insignificant place, and it prays here because of the koinonia between presbyters and bishop. And to say that it prays here is to say that it prays in the midst of this story, this local story, the whole one holy Catholic Apostolic Church. So it prays here not for the Catholics here in isolation, but for the humankind on the way to salvation here. And they are taken into the prayer of Christ in a way that is complete and utter, and that's the actual vision that lies behind it. So I'm just going to complete this with a look at some texts from Vatican II, and maybe I might leave it at that for the morning. Is that okay so far, what I've been trying to dig out? The diocese didn't come from Jesus. It developed historically. As it developed, there was a change in the functions of the sacrament of order, and the pastoral vision develops with it. And the pastoral vision is that the church can be present in many different local stories in a way that can still cause there to be the one holy Catholic and Apostolic Church in its entirety here. So in my little town, it's not a branch of the churches there. Like there's a branch of the banks there, but the big headquarters of the banks is elsewhere. And the big shots in the bank are elsewhere. In my town, the entire church is there. It's an embodiment of the church. And it's an embodiment of the church because it is in intercommunion with the diocesan embodiment of the church, which itself is in communion with the church as it stands. So in that town, Christ is present. In that town, the here means town, village. It doesn't mean in that congregation Christ is present. It means Christ is present through the congregation in the town. And that has a lot of implications for the priorities of the congregation itself. As instance in what I was saying there about education and so on and so forth. It's not a matter of panic that in the parochial school in my town, everybody is not turning out church going. It's there is present to everybody. A sacrament of salvation doesn't require that everybody be church going, if that's the way that Providence is leading them at this point in time. But it's crucial that in my town, the whole Catholic Church is present, and that's the vision that Vatican II had of it. So I'm going to do one or two bits now about Vatican II, and perhaps that's as much as I can handle for the morning. When Vatican II came to try to discuss the theology of the priesthood, it was operating in a context where the theology of the priesthood had become associated uniquely with the power to consecrate the Eucharist. So many of the classical scholastic definitions of what it means to be a priest said a priest is someone who has the power to consecrate the Eucharist. Many problems with those definitions. One are that it only concentrates on the power of consecrating the Eucharist, But the main problem with those definitions is that they did not bring the corporate nature of this vocation into clarity. They did not see that being a priest is part of being a Presbyterian. And in not seeing that, they were not seeing the local church clearly enough. And so the discussions in the council begin to work through like that. And I'm just going to show you a comment from Cardinal Marty of Paris, who was one of those that led to the Papal Presbyterium Ordinus. This is how he approached it. The Commission cannot agree with those fathers who think that the position paper should have followed the scholastic division of priesthood, which is based on the power to consecrate the Eucharist. So the majority don't want to follow that. According to the prevailing mind of this council and the petition of many fathers, the priesthood of presbyters must be connected with the priesthood of bishops. That's precisely the connection that I've been trying to illustrate historically. That came to take place historically. The latter being regarded as the high point and fullness of priesthood. Priesthood of presbyters must therefore be looked at in this draft as embracing not one function but three, and must be linked with the apostles and their mission. So the priesthood of presbyters must be linked with the priesthood of bishops and be seen as carrying out the three functions of the bishop, which are pastoral care, sacramental ministry, and the ministry of preaching. So those three together. And even deeper than that, it's saying there's no such thing as being a priest unless you see it as a corporate activity in which a bishop is a key central unifying factor. There is no reality to being a priest if you take it to mean being something in isolation from that corporate ministry in which a bishop plays a unifying role. There is no reality to it at all. And this then leads you to see what exactly is going on in the local church. The whole Christ prays there. So if you then turn to the actual formulations of Vatican II, you'll find that this is how it works them out. Is that okay? All priests, this is from Presbyterium Ordinus, all priests share with the bishops the one identical priesthood and ministry of Christ. Consequently, the very unity of their consecration requires their union with the order of bishops. So they share with the bishops the identical priesthood and ministry of Christ. There's a single priesthood which we are undertaking together and in a corporate function. This unity is best shown on some occasions by liturgical concelebration, and priests also affirm their union with bishops in the Eucharistic celebration. Bishops therefore, now they reverse it. So they've said priest is a sharing in a single ministry. It's very, very, very strong. The word now that I want to put into is not in Vatican II, but it's a very straightforward development. Interdependence in that undertaking. I depend on being in a vocation of which a bishop is a center of unity, and the bishop depends on me. Put it another way, there is no such thing as being a bishop unless it is as being the center of unity in a presbyterium. There's an interdependence between the task of being a bishop is now undertaken in the center of a presbyterium. The task of being a presbyter is undertaken as continuing the single vocation which the presbyterium has together with its bishop. It's inconceivable that I, up the mountain in Mitchelstown, would be acting as a presbyter and the whole church praying there if it wasn't the case that I was in intercommunion with that single corporate vocation centered on the bishop. There's no such thing as being a bishop unless you see it as a vocation which is exercised by the presbyterium and in union with the presbyterium. It's only an illusion that you can think of yourself as a bishop in isolation. It's an illusion that you can think of yourself as a priest in isolation. For the point of being a priest is to ensure that the whole church is present here. And the whole church cannot be present here without that koinonia. And these are the really important developments at Vatican II, which I think at least are the key elements of vision for the future. For that interdependence can itself be developed. That interdependence can itself be developed. But that's the story for later on in the week. So this is just continuing this. Bishops, therefore, because of the gift of the Holy Spirit that's been given to priests at the ordination, should regard them as their indispensable helpers. That's what I wanted to bring into focus there. That leads me to say interdependence. It's not simply a case that I depend on the bishops for the legitimacy of my undertaking. It's also the case that the bishop depends on me for a full grasp of what he is trying to undertake. There's an interdependence indicated there. Will regard them as indispensable helpers and advisors in the ministry and in the task of teaching, sanctifying, and shepherding. The very central tasks of the bishop, indispensable helpers. The two vocations have come to be linked together in a single task and in an interdependent way in the vision of Vatican II. And to my mind, you know, they worked like heck at this in Vatican II. Took a lot of argument to get away from the scholastic definition. You see, the scholastic definition said a priest is a priest when he can celebrate the Eucharist. True! But that's to forget that in celebrating the Eucharist, he's a member of a corporate vocation. And they had to fight hard to make sure that the corporate vocation element or dimension came to be at the center of the vision. And that's all because at the center of the overall vision they want to present is the local church as not a branch of the Catholic Church, but the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church exists here, up this mountain, for the sake of the people who live up this mountain, although it may be small and poor and living in the diaspora. So I think that's as much as I want to say this morning, and it was enjoyable being with you. Thank you. Right.